It was 40 years ago today, plus maybe a few months, that a group of long-haired British musicians came to America for a tour that would transform popular music. Many of us would say that, in fact, the Beatles changed the world. It's difficult to describe exactly what it was about the Beatles and their music that had such a profound effect. But I guess most of us who were young in the 1960s, and maybe many other people, just simply got it about the Beatles, and many things have never been the same since then. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, your host, and glad you can listen. During this hour, Focus 580, we'll return to the beginnings of Beatlemania in the United States and talk with a guest who has witnessed the mayhem firsthand. In 1964, Larry Kane was a 21-year-old news director at a radio station in Miami, Florida. As the Beatles began their first American tour, he thought they were a passing fad. But by a twist of fate and perhaps a misunderstanding on the part of their manager, he got invited to travel with the Beatles throughout their 1964 U.S. tour and again in 1965. 40 years later, Larry Kane has written a book about the entire adventure. It is entitled Ticket to Ride, Inside the Beatles' 1964 and 1965 Tours That Changed the World. And it's published in paperback this year by Penguin Books. During this hour, Focus 580, we'll talk with Larry Kane about the stories in the book and about the impact of the Beatles. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. After experiencing the events we'll talk about today, he continued a distinguished career in broadcast journalism and became known as the Dean of Philadelphia Television News Anchors. In fact, he served as anchor at all three of Philadelphia's network affiliates and also with the ABC network in New York City. He has covered U.S. politics, interviewing every president from Lyndon Johnson to George W. Bush, and he's reported on every national political convention since 1964. His foreign assignments have included the Middle East Peace Talks and the 1987 summit between Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev, and he was actually the first U.S. reporter to break the story of the Bay of Pigs invasion. Gee, what have I done lately? Anyway, Larry Kane joins us this morning by ISDN from his home in Philadelphia to discuss the book. And Larry Kane, good morning.
Good morning, Jack. How are you?
I'm just great. Thanks for being with us.
Great to be here.
Well, I imagine that just about every radio interview you have done on this book has started with that track, Ticket to Ride.
Just about. Some people play Can't Buy Me Love, I Want to Hold Your Hand. We got the entire gamut here. So I've heard the song many, many times over the last year.
Well, that's great. So let's dive right into the book. It's a great book and actually a page turner, I must say. Let's talk about some of the stories that it contains. A lot of great stories.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think a lot of people in the beginning. Can you hear me okay, by
sure.
the way?
Oh, yeah, just here. Just great.
A lot of people in the beginning also discounted the whole Beatle phenomenon. Mm-hmm. My father heard I was going on the tour, and he pulled me aside and said, "Watch your back. They're a menace to society." And what happened was in spring of 1964, we heard that the Beatles were coming on this mammoth tour of America. This incredible tour, and the program director of the station in Miami asked me to get an interview with them at the closest place they were coming to Miami, which was Jacksonville. Mm-hmm. So I wrote a letter to him, and in that letter, I put my business card and asked for the interview. The business card listed 7 stations. 6 of them were oriented toward African-American or Hispanic audiences. And he didn't know that, and later on I found out, first of all, he didn't know I was 21. Mm-hmm. Secondly, he didn't know that he thought I was a radio mogul.
Oh, yeah.
Owned all these stations. So he invited me on the tour, and then I went to the program director and the general manager, and I said, "I don't want to go." And they said, "Why wouldn't you want to go on this?" And I said, "Because why should a person who's covering Castro's, the evolution of the exiles from Castro's Cuba, which changed the face of South Florida, the burgeoning, blossoming war in Southeast Asia, all the things that were happening in the 60s, 64, in the aftermath of the assassination of the president, plus all the ambulance chasing I was doing in Miami and for crimes and things like that. Why would anybody like me want to travel with a band?"
Yeah.
I mean, why would I want to, you know, to me it was a trivial assignment. And to those journalist students and communication students who may be listening to this broadcast, let me just say that indecision is the fault line of failure. And if I had decided not to go that time, my entire career would have changed. So reluctantly, I joined them on August 18th, 1964, at the Hilton Hotel in San Francisco. Very nervous, carrying, by the way, Jack, a 22-pound tape recorder.
Right.
I walked into my room in the Hilton, and I opened the door, and there on the sofa was a beautiful young woman with a miniskirt, a very high miniskirt. And I said, "Am I in the wrong room?" And she said, "No, I am."
And she was looking for the Beatles, obviously.
And I said, well, what are you doing here? She says, well, I'm the stewardess on your plane. I heard you blabbing about traveling with the Beatles. I checked in under your name. And, Mr. Kane, I'm going to make you so happy tonight that you're going to get me to meet the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
Well, contrary to what many of you listening might think right now, I did not. I wasn't tantalized over this. I was a little bit excited. But I was very, very upset because she was 20 yards away from the Beatles suite.
Mm-hmm.
And I was breaching security. I then get a phone call, which saved me for the moment, from Derek Taylor, their press secretary, and went down to their suite. I interviewed Paul and George and Ringo, and then John Lennon came to me. And as you'll read in this book, he made some derogatory remarks about the way I was dressed and if I really belong there. Somewhat, I can't go into the words on the air, but along the lines that I was a square peg in a round hole.
Mm-hmm.
And I insulted him by telling him he was dressed like a slob. We proceeded to have an interview about Vietnam and some other things, and he really liked it. I walked out of the room and figured, I'm done. I am finished with the Beatles tour. I have now insulted John Lennon, and I've got this woman waiting in my room. I don't know what to do. I've got a 22-pound tape recorder. The reels are falling off. I'm
right.
A mess.
Right.
I walk out in the hall, and all of a sudden I'm spun around by Mr. Lennon. First moment of a relationship that would last till his death. And he hugged me, gave me this bear hug. And he said, I apologize. I really enjoyed that interview. And I said, well, it's something to this guy. And then I looked down the hall. And there's this tall man who I later found out was Malcolm Evans, the Beatles' second-in-command roadie. Very tall man. And there's a woman who has her arms around him. And I'm telling you right now, she is doing everything a person can do to a person in public without being arrested.
Mm-hmm.
And it was her.
The waitress.
And
stewardess.
And I never saw her again, but I will guarantee you that she got to meet the Beatles that night.
Mm-hmm.
My second experience, and I'll talk about them later, was the next night in the first concert. Now, try to understand that most adults viewed them as mop tops and mushroom heads, and they were very derogatory in their perspective on the Beatles. And I try to view it independently, but the entire adult world thought that this was just a passing fad of some strange-looking guys with weird hair, hair that today would be moderate by character. And I decided during the first concert, along with Brian Epstein, their manager, to go into the crowd to see what it felt like. And this was at the Cow Palace in San Francisco. So I stood in between, in the aisle and between the sections, in the corridor, and I was carrying my tape recorder looking at the kids. And the first thing I noticed is that the they were staring straight at the Beatles, and each one of them was absolutely convinced without question that they were singing to them.
Right.
Their tears were flowing down their eyes. There was this incredible sexual and physical energy. They were pulling at their hair. I'd never seen anything like it before in my life. In addition, these were the kids, the girls from the 1950s, the crinoline skirt age, where they wore hoop skirts and everything was so conservative, not necessarily politically, but in the way they dressed. And all of a sudden, while I was standing there watching these kids, in a split second, I was down on the floor, and my face was sort of crushed into the tape recorder, and my nose was bleeding. 100 kids had decided to rampage toward the stage, and they were literally they were walking over me.
Mm-hmm.
I got up, my nose was bleeding. A very sweet kid in a row near me, a young man, heavyset young kid, said, sit down here, sir. Come over here. You can escape the crowd. So I sat down on his seat, sort of. And what I didn't realize was, now my nose is bleeding at the time, that he was eating a soft serve, like a custard ice cream cone.
Mm.
So as I was going through this pain, the ice cream cone was melting into the center of my pants.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I got to the plane that night, and I had blood on my shirt and ice cream in my pants. And needless to say, I was the talk of the Beatles tour for a couple of days. So that was the personal trauma.
Yeah.
And then we had girls piling out of, literally falling out of air conditioning ducts, people opening your door in the middle of the night with oversized housekeeping uniforms on, 12 years old, saying, did you ask for soap, sir? Do you know the Beatles?
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. And on and on and on. But it was an amazing adventure, and I guess I could talk for hours about it.
Well, yeah, and there are a lot of great stories that came out of those two tours. I want to back up just a minute, because I'm really curious about your first conversation with John Lennon. Did you really ask him, the first question you asked him about, was it about Vietnam?
No.
Okay.
The first question I asked him was about how he felt coming to the United States. And he said to me, well, what do you think? And I said, well, are you happy to be here? And he said, are you? And then he went into the bathroom, and he came out of the bathroom, and I said, is everything? I said, how are you? He said, better now.
He was kind of a smart aleck.
I'm working on an epic that's coming out next year on his adult life, and I grew close with him. And I mean, we could talk about him for hours because he was such a fascinating personality. But this was my first meeting with him. He was very intimidating. I continued the interview and asked him about racial intolerance in the United States. And we talked about that. And then he turned it over. I turned it over to racial problems in the United Kingdom, which were beginning then. And we went into a little joust and we continued. One of the reasons that I got along with all of them so well was that I wasn't a DJ. I was a journalist. In addition, they made fun of me. You know, there's a CD that comes with this book.
Yes.
And you'll hear some of the interviews, and you'll hear them sort of very jocularly making fun of they try to imitate my voice, you know, like they were newscaster. Ringo would do that all the time. And you have the CD there so you can play some cuts from it if you want. But I will tell you one very interesting thing. Every time I ask them questions about things not related to the Beatlemania, to the fandom, to the typical questions they got every day from reporters at press conferences. What do you eat for breakfast? What do you like in hemlines? Did you wash your hair? Is your hair real? These questions were repeated day after day after day, and they were joking, and they were really insulting to them because, really, they were four young people who grew up pretty tough, who had tremendous intellects, and who were much more worldly than anybody ever imagined.
You talked about the fanaticism of the fans, and it was a phenomenon that no one had ever probably. I mean, I you know, was a little young to go to concerts during those years, but sort of unprecedented to say the least, in terms of the outpouring of emotion in these venues.
Well, it was amazing, and boys and girls too. What you saw there was really, and a lot of sociologists will take issue with me on this, but then there are those who don't. What you really saw there was the real beginning of the 60s as we know it. Remember, the president had been killed on November 22, 1963. The Beatles' first release, I Want to Hold Your Hand, was released on December 26th. The British invasion occurred, and all this excitement was being generated around them. You know, all the flack, all the newspapers, all the attention. Their first mini tour with the Ed Sullivan Show, where they managed to appear on three consecutive Sundays, viewed by about a total of 350 million people altogether. And all of a sudden, they let us forget for a while. They brought us some joy and some energy in a time when this country, and you were too young to remember, but this nation was in a tremendous period of absolute despondency. Social attitudes had deteriorated. We were, whether people loved Kennedy or they didn't, there was just a tremendous shock that this could happen in our generation, in our time. And little did we know that the 60s, the terrible 60s as we know them, were only really beginning to evolve with the war developing in Southeast Asia, the racial unrest and the battle struggle for civil rights, which was really, really coming of age. I mean, the Voting Rights Act, Civil Rights Bill of 1965 was one of the major pieces of legislation in this nation. And all of a sudden, the Beatles come on the scene. And I'll tell you the truth, for the first year and a half even, most adults in this country viewed them as aberrations. And I'll give you an example. And I think it was 65 when the Boston Pops did an album based on Beatles songs. That convinced every adult that they were fine. Okay. Once the Boston Pops recorded their music, their music was great. But as we've learned over the years, their body of music from the beginning in the late 50s to the time they broke up, starting in 69 and ending in 1970, was the greatest body of music assembled in the modern era of civilization.
This is a great phrase you have in one of the chapters early in the book when you're describing the response of the audience. You write, "I realize that for many of these young women, their love and passion for the Beatles seemed to be the beginning of liberation and the end of innocence. I also realize that perhaps their individual actions would stimulate the transformation of an entire generation." And I guess I'm wondering, do you think that the Beatles were a catalyst of some kind or simply a sort of a manifestation of a change that was really occurring anyway?
I think it's the latter. Yeah. I think that we had come from the 1950s, which were a very puritanical period time in our history. And therefore, we were in the 60s. We had had our dreams of a peaceful decade shattered by this assassination. The war was actually escalating quietly behind our backs in Vietnam. The Cold War was still dominant. We were people who were starting in a very small way to have infiltrations of drugs into our systems. By 1966, 1967, the protest movement in this country was a genuine, a very proletariat kind of, but really across all social lines, protest movement against the war, which really shaped everything. The problem with the 60s were, and this is the real problem, mm-hmm. is that everybody labeled you. This election year sort of reminds me of that. There's a, you know, if you were for the Vietnam War, that meant you had to be pro-police. Mm-hmm. Figure that one out. Mm. If you were against the war, that means you had to be anti-police. Everything was labeled into us and them. It was an us and them society. And the Beatles, I think, did a very good job of unifying the world under one great shared experience.
We're talking this morning with Larry Kane. He's a longtime journalist and author of the book we're discussing, Ticket to Ride, Inside the Beatles' 1964 and 1965 Tours That Changed the World. A bunch of the chapters in the book detail the experiences you had at each venue. And you'd travel from city to city on this airplane with the Beatles, and the security precautions in each place, you know, they took what measures they thought were necessary to control the crowds, but they never seemed to learn from episodes at the previous venues.
No, not at all. The first concert was at the Cow Palace, which was total chaos. The second two were in the Las Vegas Convention Center, which were worse than that. And then we got to Vancouver, British Columbia. Now, Vancouver, British Columbia is a, I don't know if you've ever been there, it's a gorgeous
yeah.
city.
Mm-hmm.
The people are wonderful people. And that night at Empire Stadium in 1964 was, without question, in the history of the Vancouver Police Department, the worst. There were 28,000 people at the soccer stadium, and I didn't quite understand what was going on because there was nobody on the field. Everybody was inside the in the seats, and about 7,000 of them during the middle of the concert started storming the stage. Now, normally the Beatles would, when they finished their concerts, would leave their guitars right there. The equipment people would get them together. They'd get them on the plane. Everything was all in one plane. It was a much different era than we have today. In that concert, things were so bad that they left their guitars on stage as the kids were trying. They may have been 100 police officers there, and that was a lot for a Beatles concert. And the 7,000 kids started storming like a wave. There were approximately 100 broken limbs that mm-hmm. night mm-hmm. in Vancouver. There were police horses out of control. George Harrison was heard to scream as he was leaving the stage, "Run for your life, run for your life." And it was really bad.
I shouldn't laugh because it's serious.
Yeah, very serious.
Yeah.
And there were other episodes. I mean, in Denver, Colorado, which was a beautiful city, we arrived at the Brown Palace Hotel in a sequence of limousines. We were in the second limousine. I was with the photographer and two British reporters. And the limousines had darkened windows. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, we heard people on top of the car, and they were rocking the car. And then the roof, the upholstery on the top of the Cadillac, was getting closer and closer to my head as the roof was caving in. So I was convinced at that point that I would be the first victim of death by Beatles fan.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a strange experience. But, you know, through it all, the poise of the four of them was just amazing. And I think that each one of them has been stereotyped incorrectly. They were a lot different than a lot of people expected.
Well, that's one sense you get from reading the book. The Beatles as real people. They, in fact, seem very innocent and perhaps even naive when they landed in the States for the first tour. I don't know if that's...
Well, most of their early tours were in... most of their early concerts, with rare exception, were in small theaters. You know, many of the theaters that are being resurrected nationwide right now, mm-hmm. the older theaters from the 50s,
yeah.
those were the kinds of theaters... they were in. They'd play to 300 or 400 people. When they saw 7,000 people at the 8,000 people at the Forest Hills Tennis Stadium in Flushing, New York, they were stunned. The Cow Palace was the biggest concert they'd ever had. Eventually, in 1965, when I stood on the Mets dugout mm-hmm. in Shea Stadium and watched them, nobody ever thought that 56,500 people would ever fill a stadium to see anything. So they were stunned by it in truth, and there'll be a lot of dispute about this, but in truth, they were widely accepted with even more intensity in the United States than they were anywhere else in the world, with the one exception, and that was Australia. And when they went to visit Adelaide, Australia, there were 2 million people on the parade route. So, you know, they were just accepting. I think when you look at it philosophically, poetically, musically, and magically, there really is a very special thing that was happening. Yes, there was the sex appeal of the four of them, and girls could identify with one or the other. And yes, they had the hairdos, and they had the stylish clothing, and they had the look of the times. But there was something even bigger when you put it in the mix, and that was the music.
Mm-hmm.
If you listen to their music today, and you listen to everything they did, from hard rock to melodies to almost classical tunes to country western, which Ringo loved, and you hear this music, you realize that it's pretty tough to top it, and that a lot of their music today, here in 2004, is as vibrant and fresh as it was in 1964 or in 1968. So really, it was just an amazing experience.
Indeed. Well, I wanted to ask you about your reaction to the music, because at first you weren't exactly a fan. I think you admit that you didn't particularly see what was the big deal about the music, but it did grow on you.
It grew on me. First of all, I saw in my 2 years with them and a little bit of time in 1966 and then other venues over the years, but I saw 64 Beatles concerts.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that I probably witnessed more Beatles concerts than anybody but the Beatles themselves and their party. And the music started to really become ingrained in me. And, you know, when they played, they were simply fantastic. There was no need for laser lights or flash or multimedia images like we have today or big sets. They were just spectacular. And may surprise you to know that if you watch the DVDs of the Ed Sullivan Show, or any of the, and there's very little video of them around, you'll see that they're very pure. Their music is very clean. What they did on stage was a total replication of what they did in the recorded music, and the music was so wonderful. I mean, you had songs like I Saw Her Standing There, which is a hard rock song that, to me, is the anthem song for any human being who's ever fallen in love with anybody,
yeah,
who's ever looked across a room and said, I like that person.
Yeah.
May have lasted for 30 seconds, but that was the feeling. And they just had great songs.
Could you hear the music at most of the concerts?
No, you could hear the music,
yeah,
about a third of the time.
Yeah.
The best concerts, ironically, were one not far from you guys in Comiskey Park, Chicago. There were two concerts in 1965, and the music wasn't bad there because it was a big, wide, old stadium. The amphitheater, Chicago Amphitheater in 1964, was a mess. I mean, you couldn't hear a word. It was sweaty in there. The air conditioning was off. It was a chaotic place. Little did I know, by the way, that I would be there 4 years later covering the riotous Democratic Convention.
Right.
But the best locations for the Beatles, if you want to try to get these bootleg albums, and there are a few out, was Atlanta, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
Atlanta, Georgia, Fulton County Stadium, 1965, was the greatest sound Beatles concert ever. You could hear every single word, and they put in this incredible sound system. Shea Stadium was really more of an emotional screaming experience. And I'll tell you who I always felt sorry for. I felt sorry for the opening acts.
Mm-hmm.
Because the first thing the Beatles did every night, to show you the kind of people they are, they went up front in the airplane and they checked in with the opening acts, which included the Righteous Brothers, no slouch group, Jackie DeShannon, the Bill Black Combo, and the Exciters, one of the first black girl groups in America.
Mm-hmm.
And what was interesting to me is that every night they would walk up there and chat with them just to make sure they were okay. They understood that these people were playing to a crowd of nobody really listening to them.
Yeah, people in fact shouting, "We want the Beatles, we want the Beatles.
We want the Beatles," yeah. And then these people would be singing their hearts out and doing a great job. And one group left, the Righteous Brothers left in the middle of the tour, and they were replaced by Clarence Frogman Henry. And he just enjoyed it. He had a great time being there.
Mm-hmm. We're a little past our midpoint this morning with Larry Kane, author of the book Ticket to Ride, Inside the Beatles 1964 and 1965 Tours That Changed the World, out now in paperback by Penguin Books. His last name, by the way, is K-A-N-E. I didn't remember that they'd played at the Indiana State Fair in 1964.
They played two concerts at the Indiana State Fair. One was inside, and the other was outside in the, I guess they call it the fairway or the grandstand.
Mm-hmm.
That was really interesting to me. First of all, the whole experience in Indianapolis was interesting, and I'll tell you why. It begins in Philadelphia. In Philadelphia, they played the Civic Center Convention Hall, and although they were great that night, and the usual chaos occurred, that it was a very nervous night. Do you remember the famous astrologist named Gene Dixon?
Sure, of course.
Gene Dixon, of course, supposedly gave advice to Nancy Reagan. And she had predicted that week that the Beatles would die in a plane crash on the way from Philadelphia to Indianapolis. And George Harrison had called her, and he was very upset because he hated flying. And she sort of backtracked on it. But nevertheless, we got on the plane in Philadelphia, and it was one of those white-knuckle flights all the way. And nobody said anything. I didn't really care because I figured I don't believe in that kind of stuff. And when we got to Indianapolis, everybody cheered. And we got there, and it was a very restless night, and we got in late at the Speedway Motor Inn near the Indy 500. And at 6 o'clock in the morning, Ringo, unbeknownst to us, walked up to a state trooper and says, "Take me on a ride." And he took a ride through the countryside, saw some farms, and they did a twirl around the – we all did a ride around the 500 track, which was kind of exciting. Mm. That day we went to the Indiana State Fair. Now, I'd never been to an Indiana State a state fair, period, in my life. So to see all the poultry and the animals and the farm, it was really a kick. But it was such a contrast to me, the contrast of this this really pure American tradition of a state fair with the carnival rides and the animals walking around and the 4-H competition and, you know, all the stuff that happens at a state fair. Combined with this hysteria of the Beatles. Now, the indoor concert went pretty well. The outdoor was nuts. I mean, I don't know how the Indiana State Police and the town police in that community kept the peace, but the Beatles thoroughly enjoyed it, and they really enjoyed the concept of performing at an American, the genre of American State Fair, which was so famous around the world.
Sure.
And it was really a wonderful event.
How did the police behave when trying to control the crowds?
Very well under the circumstances. Mm-hmm. Remember that police officers, by their very nature, do not like to hurt children. And these were not kids that were throwing things at them. They were just trying to get close. So the unbridled joy and energy that the kids showed came through. And unfortunately, they couldn't stop them at some time, so they really couldn't take their batons out. They just try to hold them back as best as they could. Yeah. I mean, it could have been their children. And most of the – there were two types of girls on the Beatles tour. There were what I call the candy kiss girls who would give you donuts and cake and candy kisses, you know, Hershey's kisses. And they were the sweet kids who nevertheless try to smash through police barricades, climb up fire escapes. We had one who tried to get on the wing of the airplane. They would do anything to get close to them. And then there were the others who just offer other things to get close to them for other reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And the majority of them were the sweet kids. And by the way, just in case you decide to purchase this paperback book, this is a PG-rated book.
Yes, it is.
So it's you read it, you know what it is. And although I allude to some of the things they did late at night, they did more than just have fun. Three of them were single. And John was married, and he didn't care. But we did other things late at night, too. We played Monopoly, sometimes for real money. When I lost, they absorbed the losses. When I won, they kept the money, because I had no money. And we did a lot of drinking. There were very little drug use in the 1964 tour. If anything, marijuana supplied by a young guy named Bob Dylan, heard of him. And it was really kind of a very different kind of environment. It wasn't as crazy as some of the rock groups of later years.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of the fans, you know a particular variety that was perhaps the most dangerous but also somewhat quiet, the truly obsessed, who thought that they actually were, you know, had a personal relationship with a particular Beatle.
The truly obsessed would literally get a look from in the crowd from Paul McCartney or John Lennon and believe that they were going to be married. The truly obsessed believed that there was a physical and emotional connection somewhere in heaven between them. The truly obsessed would do anything to get close and were convinced that even if they could get me a piece of candy or a note that I could slip to one of them, that was it for them.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting how that lasts, too. I have met at various Beatles functions and book signings around the nation. I have met women in their 50s. Who have said to me things like, "I've told my husband, we've been married 30 years, but I've told my husband, if Paul shows up at the door one night, my husband is toast." I'm ready to leave.
Well, I told my wife that about Hail Berry, but that's another story.
Well, Halle Berry's different. So, well, you know, I mean, yeah but that's, yeah.
Another.
But you know, I think that she's probably a lot better looking than Ringo was.
True enough.
You know, I guess. Anyway, so this is the kind of experiences that people had. And by the way, the intensity to get close to them was more than the Sinatra Bobby Soxers or the Elvis fans. This was just an absolute determination. We had a story of a kid who from Philadelphia, actually. Her name at the time was Ann Carlin, and she was 14 years old, and she went to the Forest Hills event in Queens, and they couldn't get a cab or a subway, so late at night, I don't know if you know any of the geography of New York, they walked all the way from Forest Hills to Sheepshead Bay, which is about, I think, about an 8 or 9 mile walk through the middle of Brooklyn to get home. This is the kind of intensity that occurred around the Beatles.
One of the things I thought was really interesting is that people at these concerts would throw things at the Beatles, in particular jelly beans, after one of the members of the band mentioned they like jelly beans during an interview.
Well, there was a problem. You see, in England, they sell jelly beans, but not like they sell them here. They're called jelly babies, and they're soft.
Right.
All right? Here, most of our jelly beans are kind of hard. And the shower of jelly beans began in the Cow Palace in San Francisco and ended the first year in the Paramount Theater in New York. It was very dangerous. I had many welts on my my neck and some a few on my face, and they were hit near the eye several times. So they urged people not to do the jelly beans. And after the jelly beans were over, they would start taking their pins, their Beatles pins. I love the Beatles, and throw them. And unfortunately, some of them would land on the side where the pins were.
Sure.
So it was very dangerous. And then some kids would just throw anything they could find. I don't know how the guys did it. But, you know, I've talked very little about the four of them. And I must say that their poise and their style and relaxation amid all the pageantry and craziness that went on was truly remarkable. I mean, Lennon, first of all, has been stereotyped in many, many ways. And I'm currently working on a book for Running Press Book Publishers. That'll be out late next year on his life, on his adult life, called John Lennon, The Man, The Myth, The Truth. And he's a very complex person, but I will say one thing about him. He was he had less superficiality in his mind and in his body than any human being I've ever met. He was a man who said in public what he thought in private, which can be very dangerous.
Indeed.
But yet he was a guy who was scared before concerts. He would sometimes get sick before going on stage, yet when he went there with guitar held high, his mouth practically swallowing the microphone, he was a superb, superb entertainer. On the other hand, Paul McCartney couldn't wait to get on stage. He was a man who never met a mirror or a stage he didn't like. This was a guy who literally was a tiger in the grass. He couldn't wait to get out there. When he got out there, he was probably the most spectacular stage entertainer I've ever seen. He made love to the audience with his eyes. He was just unbelievably spectacular, unbelievably. And yet, in a sense, he was the quiet Beatle because he had less to offer in terms of conversation. He always wanted to be correct. He was the man who wanted to be politically correct. While Epstein cringed every time John Lennon made a political statement, Paul was always wanted to be liked, so he kept out of controversy for the most part, until one episode in Las Vegas where I advised them that the Gator Bowl was going to be segregated in Jacksonville, and they told me on tape, led by Paul, that they would not play there.
Yeah.
Ringo Starr was hardly the goofy Beatle. Hardly. That man had an intellect as close to sharp as John Lennon's, talked a lot about politics and war, had a tremendous interest in young people. And George Harrison, who was always, you'll hear on the CD, he talks about being called the quiet Beatle. He was only considered the quiet Beatle because he didn't say anything unless he had something to say. But he had a tremendous sense of humor. He was really wry, and he really played for himself. He loved the music. On the way from Minneapolis to Portland in 1965 on the plane, we had a little flame out of an engine on the right side. And as a precaution, we had a precautionary emergency landing in Portland. John Lennon was yelling out in the back, and I wasn't far from the back row, I'm going to be Buddy Holly all over again. I'm Buddy Holly. You know, he was very nervous.
Yeah.
And George sheepishly yelled out to me, Larry, remember, if anything should happen, it's Beatles and children first. He was just a great sense of humor and a wonderful guy. They all got along beautifully, John and Paul. The myth about their differences is overblown, especially during the 70s when they were still close friends. But they had an amazing manager, Brian Epstein, who fought quite a battle inside in a day when you couldn't fight it.
Yeah.
He was gay. And in 1964, and this will shock a lot of people, being gay was a jailable offense in the United Kingdom.
Right.
So if he had gotten it, that had come out, it might have destroyed the Beatles.
Yeah. We have just about 12 minutes left with our guest, Larry Kane, last name K-A-N-E. Somebody asked that off the air, how to spell it. There it is. The author of the book Ticket to Ride, Inside the Beatles 1964 and 1965 Tours That Changed the World. I wanted to talk about Brian Epstein, in fact, a very interesting character, as you say, somewhat troubled because of the times and because of who he was. But he was really a very powerful force behind the Beatles.
No question. He was the marketer. He was the man who took them to market. He understood the need to restrict their movements and to not have photographers and film people in the place. He was extremely proprietary, so much that in Red Rock Stadium in Denver, one of the people, a DJ who came on the tour from Chicago for a few days, says Jim Staggs, went up to the top of an observation tower to see what it looked like, mm-hmm. and Epstein, with his suit on and the handkerchief in his suit, runs right after him all the way to the top. And I said to Brian afterwards, I said, what was all that about? He said, I wanted to make sure he wasn't recording the concert. I mean, he was just a guy who was totally into the business aspects of it, but he loved them, and he said something to me in 1964 that stunned me, and I thought it was just purely PR baloney. He said, Larry, the children of 2000 will be listening to the Beatles.
He saw that far ahead.
Oh, yeah. I was stunned. I mean, I thought, just another bit of pap about their career. But he was right, and sure enough, here we are in 2004 talking about it.
Do you think that his death I think it was 1967, contributed to the end of the Beatles?
I think his death contributed to the unraveling.
Yeah.
I do believe that eventually they would have broken up into separate parts anyway. But once they didn't have that firm control there, they certainly had the potential for that to happen. The breakup of the Beatles has been attributed to several factors. Yoko Ono, and she gets much of the blame, but it's not true.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It's just not true. The reason they broke up is because they all wanted to try their individual talents out alone, with the exception of Ringo, who wished the group would stay together. And so they all went off on their own, and ironically, they all did very well. And, of course, McCartney was the biggest star. But what is really interesting about it is that none of them individually ever, ever, ever equaled the sum of what they did collectively.
Well, I think we all knew that.
Yeah.
I mean, that was just, there was nothing like the Beatles, and there never will be anything. I mean, I think that's the article of faith among music fans, that they were a one-time amazing thing that is just a miracle, actually.
I think so, in many ways. I think that if you look at their background, there's one really true secret to how they were the way they were, and that's the fact that they were people who really understood the pulse of other people. And although they were very young when they began, they had experienced many, many things. I mean, the Beatles had lived in Hamburg, Germany, and lived with prostitutes and transvestites and every kind of street person you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
They had visited the royal halls of England. They had understood what poverty was about. They had seen what life was about in the post-war era. And I think their travels made them into men very quickly. But also the music that John Lennon and Paul McCartney wrote, and Ringo to some extent, and George to a larger extent, had lyrics that were true. They were not artists that were creating songs of pure love or heartbreak. They were songs that were true about real people. I'm a loser. Help. Help. I need somebody. I
Eleanor
saw her
Rigby.
Standing there. Eleanor Rigby. So you basically have a scenario where they're people that with such realistic outlooks of life. There's also another story that hasn't been told quite a bit, and only Beatles aficionados would know this, and that's there was a fifth Beatle named Stuart Sutcliffe, and he died of a cerebral hemorrhage at the age of 21. His story plays a major role in the book I'm working on, but he really influenced a lot of what they became.
Well, talk about him, because we don't hear much about him.
Well, Stuart Sutcliffe was the closest man in John Lennon's life. He was the only man that John Lennon really loved. And I don't mean that in a romantic sense, although there's some speculation about that. But he was the best friend that you always have. And they met each other when they were both about 16. They had this incredibly chemical relationship where they knew what each other was thinking. Stuart was an artist, and his art was very anarchist art. It was very anti-establishment. And John, of course, was anti-establishment from the time he was sucking his bottle, okay? I mean, he was an anti-establishment person. And Stuart played a major role in influencing the style of the Beatles in terms of the clothing. His girlfriend, or his fiance, was a woman named Astrid Kirchner, and she designed many of the early outfits. Mm-hmm. And she also designed some of the early album covers. And he was a great influence on the Beatles and a tremendous influence on John. I don't think John's life was ever the same after he died. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of controversy about a beating that John gave him back about 7 or 9 months before he died, which some people say may have contributed. There's a lot of controversy about that. But there's no question that the spirit of Stuart Sutcliffe positively and negatively impacted and haunted John Lennon for the rest of his adult life. Mm-hmm. He was a remarkable artist whose art, by the way, is now being shown around the world. And he also, there's a movie some years ago that's a wonderful rental movie, by the way, called Backbeat.
Right.
Which is basically the story, without saying who they are, of the Beatles in Hamburg and the relationship of Stuart Sutcliffe, who I believe is played by Stephen Dorff, the actor. And an incredible experience that these guys had in Hamburg, and how Hamburg really set the stage for their enormous success. He was the fifth Beatle. And then there was another Beatle, you know, Pete Best, who was mm-hmm. the original drummer,
sure.
who was booted out of the band. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some interesting early stories. But there's no question that the heart and soul of what the Beatles became was Paul McCartney and John Lennon.
Yeah. Well, and the other fifth Beatle that people talk about is George Martin.
Well, George Martin, I never met, and he never toured with them, mm-hmm. but he certainly played a major role, and you have to thank Brian Epstein for that. And Mr. Martin has written extensively about his experiences, and he really helped them arrange their music to the point where it became internationally acclaimed and famous. But they wrote the music, he arranged it, and I think one of the greatest contributions George Martin has ever made is an album that's been out about 6 years now.
Mm-hmm.
Called The Beatles at the BBC.
Yes.
And it's really pretty amazing because it's really the broadcast of the guys live without any special accompaniment. And the purity of their music is amazing. And you hear them, you know, giggling and chuckling with each other. And you hear them a little bit off key, which happens sometimes in a live broadcast. But it's so pure Beatles. It's so fantastic.
Mm-hmm. I also wanted to ask you to talk a bit more about John's activism. Later, you know, in the 60s, he began to speak out more on Vietnam, civil rights, etc. In fact, he became very, very outspoken.
Well, he became outspoken because that's the way he felt, but he was an equal opportunity protester. His protests were really not against the United States. They were against any war, the war in Biafra, the wars in Africa that were taking place, the inhumane conditions there. John Lennon was a man who spoke for other people in a very eloquent way. He wasn't blinded by radical organizations, although some tried to get a hold of him.
Mm-hmm.
He was, as you know, under investigation by the United States government in the early to mid-70s, and the Nixon and Ford administrations tried desperately to get him deported.
Yeah, that's
and
an amazing
didn't.
Thing.
And it's
yeah.
an amazing story when you look back at it. It involved one marijuana conviction back in England, and they didn't succeed. And there was one great thing about John Lennon. I think that's why Americans love him the best, is because he truly wanted to be in America. There's no question he would have applied for citizenship here. He lived in America for almost 11 years, and this is where he wanted to be. The others went back to England and estates all over the world, and John wanted to be on 72nd Street in Central Park West in New York.
Yeah.
That's where he wanted to be, and that's where his widow still lives.
Well, you developed a very close relationship with John, continuing over the years.
Well, one thing I will never forget is what he did for me in 1975. My mother passed away from multiple sclerosis back in 1964, He remembered that. In 1975, we had a radio marathon in Philadelphia for 3 days, May 16th through 18th. He came for the entire weekend. He co-hosted it. But more than that, he did something that was pretty amazing. He said, I want to go on the air with you. And I said, John, I don't do radio anymore. I'm now a television news anchor. You can't just pop in the middle of the newscast. And he said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll do the weather. So as you see in the book, there's a picture of him doing the weather on Channel 6 in Philadelphia. And it was pretty stunning to have John Lennon doing the weather forecast. And of course, nobody heard the weather. We had to bring in somebody at the end of the program to do the weather that you didn't get.
Well, he was just clowning around.
Oh, he was having a ball.
Yeah, the outlook is sunny, but the weather is funny, and you should find a yellow submarine.
He was very good. He was a great guy.
Yeah. Well, we had a question off the air. I think people hearing your voice are somewhat intimidated because you have such a wonderful voice that they don't want to compare themselves. At least that's how I feel. But the caller had always heard that Stu and Lennon were attacked back in Liverpool, and that's where Stu was brain damaged, and then a later beating that Lennon gave Stu.
Stu was attacked by we called them juvenile delinquents in the United States. They had groups in England called Teddy Boys, mm-hmm. and they were the tough guys. And he was beaten. So the beat up by John was really the second one. And no one really knows from an autopsy or anything else what happened to him or why all this happened. His sister, Pauline, says that she feels that these beatings contributed. Mm-hmm. But he was a very, very handsome guy. A lot of the young boys in England resented that. So he was roughed around a bit, and then, of course, he was beaten by John. But John loved him, so there was no way that John would have tried to hurt him intentionally.
Yeah. Well, you're researching a book, writing a book on John Lennon now that's due out next year, as you mentioned, and certainly look forward to reading that. You knew him quite well, but there are some surprising things that you're finding as you do that?
Well, if you're a Beatles aficionado and you've read everything there is, maybe they're not surprising. If you are a person who wants to know more about them, they will shock you. Mm-hmm. His life was an extraordinary life, surrounded by three elements, an enormous amount of creativity, an astronomical level of hostility, mm-hmm. and a hidden and very special love that he was never able to show. And I think that what you find out in John Lennon's life is that there's a triumph of the human spirit despite all the gremlins that surrounded him, all the drugs and all the infestations of pills and all the bad choices, that his life was really commandeered by the good spirit inside. So there's a lot of very difficult things that I've had to write about him. And a lot of very difficult things that I've discovered that I didn't even know. But I think people will find out that the triumph of his creativity came out in the end. And, of course, his life was cut short by a lunatic. And, it's very, very sad that he wasn't able to create even more. But he left an imprint. You know, some people leave an imprint in death that's even bigger than in life. And believe me, he was big in life.
Indeed.
You know.
We just have about a minute and a half left. I guess I want to ask you, as a journalist, you've covered, presidents, wars, all kinds of things, international affairs, politics, you name it, and you've covered the Beatles. What does it mean to you? What does it mean to you that you had that opportunity?
Well, it means a lot to me. I've covered stories that may have had more impact, but probably not. I just got back from the two conventions, which I did commentary for on all-news radio station. I retired as an anchor about a year and a half ago, and I still do a lot of consulting work and other news work, other writing. But it was interesting. At the Republican convention, I was sitting there right off the floor, and I was broadcasting, and a congressman walked in from Iowa, I think, and he was introduced to me by a congressman from Delaware County, Pennsylvania. And I don't remember the congressman's name, but the first thing he said to me was, I hear you got a book on about the Beatles. What were they really like?
Wow.
So this is, the thing that travels with me. In the Philadelphia area, where I'm fairly well known because I've been on the air so long, people really know I travel with the Beatles, but it's not their primary focus on my career. around the nation it is, and I'm not ashamed of it. I have no problems with it. People ask me if it was like Almost Famous, But it was, except for the sex and the drugs. I mean, if I had that good of a time, I don't think I could have written the book. But it was no question, it's one of the most important stories I ever covered. And I never really thought it was. And that's the message. The message to communications people is indecision is the fault line of failure. Never turn down a story just because you think it's not deserving. You never know where it's going to lead you.
Well, we're very glad to have some of your time, and we'll have to leave it there with those thoughts. A good place to leave it. I will suggest for folks, if you'd like to know more of the story, look for the book Ticket to Ride, Inside the Beatles 1964 and 1965 Tours That Changed the World. It's a great read, and the author is Larry Kane, K-A-N-E, published in paperback now by Penguin Books. And to you, Larry Kane, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. It was a great interview. I really enjoyed it.